Hello, folks, and welcome to Chapter 2. Again, I apologize if you hear the sound of a fan in the background. It is kind of hot in here as I am recording this lecture. So the fan is literally blowing on me. My place is kind of set up oddly. The unit for the heating and air conditioner is in the living room. I'm in the bedroom, and so I have a fan on top of the heating unit, air conditioning unit, blowing the air down, and then another fan blowing it into the bedroom, and then another fan in the bedroom itself. So again, I apologize. You may be hearing off and on the sounds of all three fans going on at the same time. Let's get into Chapter 2 of the textbook. Again, I'm going to attempt to discuss some things that are not discussed in the book, because, again, I don't see any point in my simply repeating what is in the text to you. I could do that, but I generally try to avoid that with my online classes because I think it's kind of boring. Now, if you were here and you had the ability to ask me questions as I'm talking, that might make sense. But considering I'm just sitting here in my bedroom by myself speaking into my microphone, I think that would largely be a waste of time. So let me talk a bit about the relationship between theory and methodology. Theory was addressed in Chapter 1. Methodology, methods, research methods are addressed in Chapter 2. In all sciences, whether social sciences or physical sciences or natural sciences, there is a very strong and close relationship between theory and methodology. Ultimately, you can't have one without the other. Science, in a way, and theory are pretty much the same thing. The sociological and generally scientific definition of theory is explanation or scientific explanation. The definition of science is also scientific explanation. So really the two terms science and theory are almost interchangeable. Contrary to what a lot of people think, theory is not opinion, theory is not common sense, theory is not a concept, and theory is not a hypothesis. A hypothesis is a prediction. Some people have defined hypothesis as a kind of question, where basically you are trying to find the answer to something that is unsolved. You're trying to resolve a dilemma or a problem of some sort. Some people have called it a speculation. The way you get hypotheses is from theory. So theory is the source of hypotheses. And you can't do scientific research without hypotheses. What a hypothesis is a statement which defines the relations between two or more variables. Generally, an independent variable and at least one dependent variable. Let me define what those terms mean. An independent variable is the cause. A dependent variable is the effect. Typically, any hypothesis will have one independent variable. Sorry, change that. We'll have one dependent variable, but possibly multiple independent variables, meaning you're trying to find out what causes something. Say, for example, I'm trying to find out why it snows. Well, asking the question why it snows, the snow itself, or why it snows, is, and the snow is a dependent variable. Or at least it has the potential to be one if I define it specifically and scientifically enough, if I define snow in measurable terms. Well, there might be multiple reasons why it snows. Could be temperature is one factor, the presence of moisture in the air, the presence of a certain weather current in the air, all sorts of reasons that might go into snow. Those different reasons why it snows are all independent variables. So, in effect, that is the relationship between independent and dependent variables. In a way, you can say that the relationship between theory and research is kind of a circle. You begin with theory. In other words, you begin with an explanation. A number of different theories were discussed in the previous chapter. Last week we talked about one of them, critical realism. If you read chapter one, you know there are numerous others. The book discussed functionalism, conflict theory, symbolic interactionism, as well as various feminist theories. And there are many, many other theories as well. You begin with that theory, and then you practice what is called deduction. Deduction, D-E-D-U-C-T-I-O-N. That means that you develop hypotheses from the theory. That is deduction, the process of developing hypotheses from the theory. Once you have done that, you test the hypotheses to see if the hypotheses support the theory. So, pardon me. The entire point of research is to develop theory, to develop better and better explanations. Ultimately, you want to have a theory that works really, really well. Unfortunately, because sociology is a social science, or in Europe they would say a human science, it is not as precise as, say, physics or chemistry or biology. As a result, in biology, for example, there is one dominant theory. That theory is called the modern synthesis. The modern synthesis is the current version of evolutionary theory, which dominates most of biology. And similarly, in most of the other so-called hard sciences, there are only one or two major theories which tend to be dominant. In sociology, on the other hand, being a soft science, meaning a science which studies human beings, so we're not as predictable as atoms or molecules or chemicals, you end up with multiple theories that are used to explain the same thing. So very commonly, sociologists will get into arguments over what is the best theory. So when you're doing research, again, you start out with a theory, you deduce hypotheses from the theory, and then you test the hypotheses to see if they support the theory. That process of testing hypotheses to see if they support the theory is referred to as induction. That is I-N-D-U-C-T-I-O-N. Unfortunately, I don't have a whiteboard to write this stuff down, so I have to spell things out periodically. And that is, in a sense, what methodology is, in a nutshell. Methodology is a theoretical act. Theory is the beginning point of research, and it is also the end point of research. Research begins with theory, and it ends with theory. Let me very briefly touch on the major, or at least some of the major, research methods that are mentioned in your book, and I will try to discuss them in a way so that it is not overly repetitive of what is contained in your book. First, survey research. Survey research is probably the research method that we are known for the most in sociology. Surveys are carefully constructed with fixed questions, where the same questions are asked to a sample of the population. You generally don't ask everyone in the population, say the population is all the students at Johnson County Community College. Instead, you get a sample. A sample is kind of like pulling names out of a hat without looking. That way you end up with what is called a random sample or a scientific sample. And those are the people that you ask the questions to. Now, surveys are of two basic types. One is called an interview schedule, and the other is called a questionnaire. With an interview schedule, you actually have people that you pay, not sociologists usually, but members of the community, students, anybody really, who either calls people up on the phone or in some cases goes door to door if you have enough money to do it that way, which is becoming rarer these days, and asks people questions from the survey. The second is a questionnaire, which is much cheaper, because all you do is you write out the questionnaire, the survey, you put it in an envelope, and you mail it out. You mail it out to a sample. Now, you can do it through email. The problem is it's difficult getting a random sample of email addresses. Unless you have a closed population, say people who work in a company, and you can get a random sample of the email addresses in that company, it's difficult doing it through email. So usually, but not always, questionnaires use snail mail, not email. Second, an experiment. Most people associate research with experiments, although actually experiments are done very rarely in sociology. An experiment is where you have a cause and you have an effect. In a classical experiment, you have at least two groups. One group is called the control group. The other is called the experimental group. The control group does not receive the treatment, and the experimental group does. Let me give you an illustration of that. Say I'm doing a study of the effect of violent television programming on people, what they do, what they think, say, about capital punishment. That's what I'm trying to find out. How does violent TV programming affect attitudes toward capital punishment? Well, I have one group, the control group, put them in a room. Don't expose them to any violent TV programming. Another group, the experimental group, expose them to several hours of violent television programming. And at the end, see if there are any significant differences between the two groups. If there are differences, then we can conclude tentatively that this type of violent TV programming does affect attitudes toward capital punishment one way or another. Next thing we'll talk about is what is called field research or participant observation. If you are doing the nation state's semester exam, assuming you've read the syllabus, you know what that is, you will be doing participant observation. In participant observation, you are doing two things at the same time. First, you are being a participant, and second, you are being an observer. Usually we don't do both at the same time. If I go to a movie, I'm an observer. I'm not a participant. If I go to a party, I'm a participant. I'm not primarily an observer. With participant observation or field research, I'm doing both. The idea is that by participating, I can get a better sense of what I am observing than if I am simply sitting in the background on a chair taking notes. The actual process of participation can enhance my understanding of the events taking place in whatever situation I am observing. The final research method that we'll talk about is analysis of secondary sources, secondary data analysis. This is usually the cheapest method to use. For example, you can go to the U.S. Census site, which is census.gov, and download census information for free. Similar information is available from similar sites in other countries around the world, and generally it is also free. Since it is paid for by taxpayer money, there's no cost involved. Then you take that information and you analyze it. You analyze it using basic methods, including statistics. Sociologists generally are also statisticians, at least to some extent. Statistics is not really that hard. I remember when I first started studying sociology, I was kind of afraid of statistics. I never really cared much for math, never took calculus, never took trigonometry. In college, for my math requirements, I took statistics as one course and logic and sets as the other one. So I tried to avoid math as much as possible. But in this particular type of research, analysis of secondary data, you need to use statistics. So in a sense, you are statistically analyzing the data that has been collected by other people. That's why it's called secondary data analysis, because you have not collected the information yourself. Instead, you are relying upon information which is collected by others. Now, the problem with that. First, one, if the set of data you're using does not have the kind of information you want, you can't use it. The positive thing, it's cheap. It's free. The only thing it really takes is time. So a lot of people who want to do sociological research but don't have a whole lot of time will do either analysis of secondary data or participant observation. We will conclude with a discussion of research ethics. Ethics are very, very important, not only in sociology, but in all sciences. One of the most important ethical principles to keep in mind is informed consent, meaning you don't subject people to anything that might cause harm to them unless you have their consent in advance. And you make sure that the consent is really, really specific. In research, people are always more important than research. There is no exception to that principle. Never. People are always more important than research. So if you can't do research without subjecting people to harm, or at least without getting people to consent to a situation where they might be subjected to harm, which happens more commonly in medical research where drugs are being tested on people, then you simply do not do the research. That wraps up the lecture for today. Have a good week, and I will speak with you again next time.